and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. In the West, it's called a marriage of convenience, but for Russia and China, their relationship is strategic and an alternative to the West's so-called rules-based order. What the West refuses to recognize, the Russians and the Chinese practice, and is called multipolarity. Crosstalking Multipolarity, I'm joined by my guest, Andy Mok in Beijing. He is a senior research fellow at the Center for China and Globalization. Also in Beijing, we have Zhang Gong. He is a professor at the University of International Business and Economics. And in New York, we cross to Danny Haifeng. He is the host of Left Lens. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Andy, let me go to you in Beijing. Do you like the term marriage of convenience? Because it sounds very arrogant to me, because it means that the West is the proper suitor for other countries. There's a built-in bias if you think about it. Go ahead, Andy.
No, there absolutely is. And I think, you know, I did a video for CGTN last month about how Western media is subtly and invisibly poisoning its audiences with these insinuations and these distortions. And this phrase, marriage of convenience, is exactly one of those.
Well, John, the same question to you, because they've been talking about this marriage of convenience for a long time. And all the while, Russia and China has reached out to each other. They've reached out to the entire world. You know, the marriage of convenience is more like the United States and its NATO allies. I would say that's a shotgun marriage of convenience, okay? Absolutely. I mean, if your best ally destroys a pipeline of yours, what kind of marriage is that, okay? But on a more serious note, John, I mean, again, this is a very arrogant narrative about how the world should revolve around the West, but it's not so much anymore. And that's what really irritates them. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I wouldn't characterize this as a marriage, because otherwise both countries would be accused of polygamy. I guess China maintains this kind of relationships with many countries. But I think what's unique here is that Russia is currently, as we all know it, you know, engaged in a war in Ukraine. You know, the entire West is fighting, essentially, in my view, is fighting against it. Now, China takes a neutrality position. China still maintains a, you know, fairly good relationship with most countries, and in this case, particularly with Russia. I think, you know, it's a very special relationship in the sense that Washington accuses China of being siding on the Russian side, which is something that Beijing categorically denies. Nevertheless, I think you know, both countries look at the economic relationship, political relationship, they're both thriving. So I think, you know, may not be a marriage, but certainly it's an example of maintaining a good relationship, a strategic relationship between great powers in an era of, you know, immense conflict at this point.
Well, I'm glad that, John, you talk about it in great powers, because the West doesn't like that. OK, that smacks of spheres of influence and stuff like that. Actually, you know, we're going back to traditional geopolitics of great powers. And I think it's healthy because it breaks hegemony. And when one country has hegemony, it is dangerous for the entire system. And this is what we're seeing. Danny, you know, Russia and China and other countries are challenging the West, but they're not only challenging the West, they're presenting an alternative. And this is what the West doesn't tell their publics, that there is an alternative way of doing geopolitics that is more peaceful and absolutely more prosperous for all people in the world. And it's no wonder that Russia and China appeal to the global South, or the global majority, as I think it should be called. Go ahead, Danny.
Well, that's exactly right. And what Russia and China are doing is, through their strategic partnership, they're actually leading by example in a way that has hitherto not existed prior. During the Cold War, there was a lot of confrontation and a lot of antagonism between the rising powers to the east, China and Russia, and of course the United States. Now Russia and China have turned in this direction of multipolarity and have made it very clear that they're not targeting any third party, and that they would, if they could, have relationships, real strong relationships, with the collective West and with the United States. But what they are actually doing is taking the high ground here, and that is driving the neocon foreign policy establishment absolutely mad. because what Russia and China are actually doing through their strategic partnership is showing the world that the United States and the collective West aren't actually needed at this time, that two rising powers, developing countries that are fast becoming leaders in the global South, can actually chart a path forward internationally that doesn't include the problems and the consequences of unipolar hegemony that the United States has shown quite clearly is a disaster for the planet, whether we look at Ukraine or whether we look at the rest of the world and how it is faring under U.S. domination.
Leading by example. You're absolutely right. Andy, this is what's really important here is that, you know, what Danny just told us, you know, not targeting a third country. But the West, they want to have a relationship that it suits them and their interests only, and everyone else has to adapt. Now, for a good for the post-war environment, yes, that happened quite a bit. But it's no longer happening anymore, and more people are rejecting this kind of arrangement on the global stage. When one country decides everything, there's no check on that one country, and that's what makes it very dangerous for the international system, and I would even say for Western publics as well. Go ahead, Andy.
Well, that's absolutely true, Peter, and I think the key phrase here or term is hypocrisy, and this is not just on the international stage, but domestically as well, and I think this is what the U.S. and the dwindling handful of countries that stand with it are so afraid and I think angered by, in that when we look at the exploitation domestically, that most Americans really are in a state of debt peonage, and that this is replicated on the global stage as well. That what China and Russia and other countries are showing is there is another way that works just as well, if not better, than the quote-unquote American way. And if enough Americans see this, you know, I think this is going to create real problems for the sustainability of the American power structure. I mean, we're seeing this change, as President Xi mentioned, these changes unseen in 100 years.
Yep.
That could also spark a reappraisal domestically in the U.S. as well. And I think this is what is so threatening.
Yeah, well, you know what's threatening, John, is that in a very short amount of time, China brokered a deal between Iran and Saudi Arabia, presented the world with a peace plan for Ukraine. Oh, my goodness, why are the Chinese doing this? How dare they get involved in these things? This is what is so astounding. Watching American cable news, their hair is on fire. It's that we're supposed to do this. Yeah, you've been doing it for like 70 years, and you've screwed up the world pretty badly. Maybe you should pass the baton to somebody else for a change. I think that will resonate with the American public if they were explained in a very truthful manner what's going on. Of course, they're not. Go ahead, John.
Well, I concur most of what you said, but let's be a little bit honest here, is that Saudi Arabia and Iran have been engaged in sort of, you know, behind door negotiations for quite a while, actually, just by themselves. I think, but what's significant here is that finally they cut the ribbon, they shake hands in Beijing. I think this is the most significant event. And I think this is, you know, from what I've read so far, it's mostly of the Saudi Arabia's choosing, actually. And I think, you know, the prince over there, people call him MBS, did this deliberately. He made this thing happen in Beijing to make a point to Washington that you know, there's another power broker here in the Middle East. In honesty, I don't think China wants to play a sort of a substitutional role vis-a-vis Washington. I think, you know, Beijing maintains good relationships with practically every party, every player in the Middle East. I mean, you're talking about Persians, the Jews, the Arabs, or the Turks. You know, China maintains good relationships with each one of them, and is a major trade partner, if not the largest trading partner, with each one of these countries. So I think, you know, China's engagement in the Middle East is mostly from a commercial point of view. It's also from a sort of a, you know, a good diplomatic relationship point of view. Nevertheless, I think, again, I want to emphasize that this event is significant in the sense that it marks the ending of an era of America, you know, totally dominating the landscape of the Middle East. Now there's a new player in town.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought up that point there. Danny, I mean, I'll be more specific in my question to you, but basically the same theme, is that, you know, China is not replacing the United States. That's not what it's trying to do. But China is a great power involved with the Saudis and Iranians. They're not choosing sides. See, the U.S. always chooses a side, okay, and generates a conflict. The Chinese are saying, no, you guys can shake hands and you can do it in our capital, but it's up to you to move it forward. And I think that's the message that Beijing was sending. And Beijing is not picking a side in a conflict. That's very wise for a great power. Go ahead, Danny.
Yeah, and what China is doing, too, is they're demonstrating what exactly is important in international relations. What exactly is the most important factor in developing stable international relations? And that is economic cooperation. And so what China has done all around the world through its various mechanisms like the Belt and Road Initiative is mirror the stability that it is experiencing right now internally. So all of what is being laid diplomatically for China, all of its ascendancy in the diplomatic sphere and in a leadership sphere economically and politically is all made possible by its domestic stability. And that's one aspect of this that doesn't get much conversation here, but China doesn't take sides because it understands in order to have stability internationally, there has to be cooperation at a very broad and a very deep level. That doesn't mean that China doesn't take positions, that has taken a position on the Ukraine crisis. It has made clear that it takes all the security interests of all parties concerned. It also has taken positions on issues like sanctions and has opposed them, and it opposes any kind of unilateral aggression. So China has taken positions worldwide, but has understood that in order to have stable international relations, in order to develop in a peaceful manner, and in order to ensure that all the interests as fully as possible are met
very
between
well
all
said.
Parties.
Danny, my friend, I have to jump in. We have to go to a hard break. And after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on multipolarity. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaVelle. To remind you, we're discussing multipolarity. Okay, let's go back to Andy in Beijing. You know, Andy, I'm a child of the Cold War. I don't really hide my age, okay? I was brought up during the Cold War. I remember the rhetoric. I remember some of the crises as well. And it would seem to me that, you know, when I was being brought up, you know, it was the communist bloc, the ideology and mercilessness and the grayness and all. And it was really evil. It was really pitched that way. But, you know, now with the end of the Cold War, it's the West that's become intensely ideological and intensely biased. I mean, again, I work in the news business. I'm a media person and I watch a lot of media. And just how vapid Western media is when it comes to countries like China. And China is the least ideological on the world stage of the great powers. Go ahead, Andy.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, I think one of the big differences is the U.S. during the Cold War and today really demonizes and seeks to divide, whereas the Chinese approach is based on two foundational principles that are related. The first is benevolence, and the second is maturity. And I think this is very, very different. And we see this reflected in China's foreign policy approach. And I want to go back to John's point about Saudi Arabia, that this was highly symbolic. And I think what's so important here is that it also may mark the unraveling of American hegemony, which is based on the petrodollar. So we go back in history. That Nixon, by abandoning the gold, pegging the dollar to gold and making it a fiat currency, essentially a worthless piece of paper, that the only way the U.S. could keep the game going was by strong-arming the Saudis into taking dollars for oil. And that was allowed the dollar to continue. And now we may see the end of that as the Saudis are symbolically showing a greater independence and practically accepting the yuan for oil, that we may be on the cusp again of these changes unseen in 100 years.
Well, to that point, John, I mean, this is, you know, again, I've stated also already on this program is that, you know, the West turns it into a confrontation, but so many countries like Russia and China are saying, well, no, we don't want confrontation with you. We're just going to do things in a different way, an alternative way. You can join us if you want, but if you don't want to join us, a lot of people are going to follow us. I'm thinking of like the BRICS and things like this, where there's a world beyond the West. There's a very long literature about this, actually. And so, you know, avoiding confrontation and looking for a more harmonious way of moving forward. And again, you know, the last 70 years have been so turbulent, it's time to change your way of looking at the world. Hegemony is dangerous. Multipolarity is the way forward. I think this is what the great powers of China and Russia are saying. Go ahead, John.
You're absolutely right. You know, that's exactly what's happening here. But, you know, this is a scenario certainly Washington doesn't like it. And it's trying to, at least in the global media war, trying to sugarcoat it as something else. You know, essentially, you know, this confrontation in Ukraine is somehow framed as a battle between the democracy world and authoritarian world. Interestingly, you know, I delivered a speech just recently, actually in Moscow, a few weeks ago at a Voter Forum. My argument is that, look, you know, you look at all the countries. Let's talk about Middle East here. All the countries who take a position on this war, who take a position regarding the sanctions on this war, unanimously, none of any countries in the Middle East has taken a sanction approach towards Russia. And these countries range from full democracy, as for example in Israel, to monarchies such as Saudi Arabia, from, you know, highly religious countries to secular countries, from Washington's arch enemies to Washington's closest allies, and from all kinds of political spectrums. So I think, you know, this narrative of democracy against authoritarianism is totally nonsense, you might.
Well, you know, Danny, I mean, you can think of the January 6 prisoners or hostages, if you want to call them, in the United States. Not very democratic there. I mean, democracy is challenged within the United States, let alone exporting it to other countries in the world. Danny, what does the term rules-based order mean to you? Because I've been hearing this now for the entire Biden administration, and I can't get a straight answer. What does it mean? Because when I listen to President Xi, I listen to President Putin, I understand what they want to do, non-interference of other countries, sovereignty, respect sovereignty of other countries. But then they throw in the rules-based order. What does it mean to you?
Well, rules-based order is essentially code for U.S.-led order, a U.S.-dominated world order. That's really all it is, because the United States has trampled all over international law for more than 70 years since the end of World War II. And the United States, even at this moment, is so open and blatantly hubristically arrogant about issues like the Ukraine crisis, for example, where on the one hand they say they respect Ukraine's sovereignty, and on the other say they could never allow Ukraine to tack onto or agree to a Chinese-led proposal for peace. So really all the U.S. Is talking about when it talks about a rules-based order is a U.S.-dominated order, one where the U.S. makes the rules and the U.S. enforces its own rules, which generally means dominating other countries, destabilizing entire regions, and economically and politically benefiting from these imperialistic ventures.
You know, Andy, we listened to Stoltenberg, the head of NATO. He's on the way out, but he has great ambitions for the alliance, going into the Pacific now. But I thought NATO was a defensive alliance. Why does it need to go on the other side of the world? What is it defending there? Okay? I mean, this doublespeak that keeps coming out of Western capital. No, we're just defensive. We're defensive here. Well, then why do they have a string of bases around China and the South China Sea? Oh, it's called the South China Sea because it's next to China, right? Go ahead, Andy.
Well, I think there's a couple of interesting things going on with this, Peter. So first of all, we have to recognize that NATO is really not as independent as it might want to portray itself, that the U.S. plays a very decisive role. And the U.S. recognizes that just as it cannot compete with China fairly economically, that it has to resort to these kind of underhanded tactics to try to slow down China's development rather than improving itself. It also recognizes that it cannot engage in these military efforts to contain China on its own and has to marshal what resources it can. And I think this is where we see NATO coming into play here. But the other thing we have to recognize, too, to come back to this idea of changes unseen in a century, is that the original logic for NATO was to keep Germany down, Russia out, and the U.S. in. And I think there's a growing awareness in Europe and in Germany that should Germany be kept down forever, and that is it time for Germany to take a greater role, and in fact, a rapprochement with Russia makes a lot of sense. And I know many German business people that it's very impolitic to say these things, but, you know, they recognize the reality. And we may be, again, witnessing an unraveling and a realignment here of, you know, that may see the end of NATO.
Well, you know, John, absolutely what Andy just said here. I mean, and this is the whole point of this conflict in Ukraine that was provoked by NATO expansion after the illegal coup in Kiev in 2014. I mean, and then you have the pipelines blow up here. Well, everybody knows why that was done, and it was exactly for the reason that Andy just cited, is to break any kind of a strong relationship between Germany and Russia. Well, they succeeded, okay? And the future of Germany's economic base is in question right now. Without cheap energy, it's not going to be the powerhouse of Europe, okay? But, you know, when you see a hegemon that is declining, we can see that it gets quite dangerous. I mean, provoking a war in Ukraine, blowing up pipelines, backing the International Criminal Court when they're not even a member of it. I mean, this is really reckless. I would be worried if I were you in Beijing.
Well, the notion that the NATO is a defense organization is probably one of the biggest jokes in international relations. Obviously, it's not. And when Stoltenberg was talking about, you know, NATO partners, for example, in the Asian Pacific region, it's very worrisome to me. So every time, you know, you're talking about security architecture, so-called security architecture, and security from whom? You have to ask this question, security from whom, right? So immediately you stir up a sort of antagonistic relationship with somebody. And that's very worrisome. I think, you know, we have to be, as Asian here, and I'm a firm believer in that, you know, leave the Asian matters to the Asians. NATO has no business in the Indo-Pacific region. It's no business in the Indian Ocean. It's no business in the Pacific Ocean. This whole notion of, security architecture, you know, NATO partners here in this region, it totally doesn't make sense at all. Nevertheless, you know, apparently this is a direction that I think that NATO is going to take, and doesn't very bode well for peace and prosperity in this region. That's very worrisome.
Danny, we have 40 seconds left. You can finish it up for us. I agree with what Andy and John have just said here. We're in very dangerous times right now. 40 seconds to you, Danny.
Sure. Well, the United States and the collective West are backing themselves further and further into a corner. The more aggressive they become toward Russia and China's partnership, the more actually they bring them closer together. And furthermore, it's not as if Russia and China don't have strategic interests of their own, which necessitate cooperation and actually leave the United States and the collective West on the sidelines. And that's exactly why there's such a problem with this partnership from the United States' side.
That's right, because they don't have to be a suitor. They think that they're indispensable. They're indispensable. They are so necessary. No, they're not. And that's what we're finding out. They're not necessary. The West is not necessary for the world to move forward. And that is a very, very bitter pill for the West to swallow. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Beijing and in New York, and I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk Rules.